Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, March 7, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear a discussion of the oral argument in the Supreme Court case Hernandez v. Mesa. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Stephen Geyer, Senior Counsel on the House Committee on Homeland Security. I will turn it over to Stephen to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Stephen. The floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Laura, very much, and good afternoon, everyone. Yes, here to talk about Hernandez v. Mesa. It was heard on February 21st before the Supreme Court, the eight-member Supreme Court right now. I'll briefly go through the facts and briefly the procedural history before going into sort of what happened at the court and what was asked and by whom and which way I might see it tilted here. So anyways. The facts as alleged, and it's important to note at the beginning here that the facts are in dispute, but this is a motion to dismiss, and so we have to go with the facts as alleged in the complaint. And so they are that in 2011, I believe, 15-year-old Sergio Hernandez was playing with a friend in a concrete culvert between El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez in Mexico. And I'm going to spend a couple minutes here talking about this culvert because it came up a lot in oral argument. It's sort of important for everybody to sort of understand what it is. So if you would imagine that between El Paso and Ciudad Juarez, there is this concrete strip going north to south, to the east of this concrete strip of land is a fence that is on the United States side, and to the west is another fence that is on the Mexican side. The official border of the United States and Mexico is right down the middle of the culvert, although there is no painted line or chalked line that says U.S. Mexico. And running perpendicular to this culvert is a elevated rail bridge. And there are pillars from the rail bridge that go down into the culvert. This culvert, concrete culvert, is jointly operated and maintained and repaired by the United States and Mexico. Both pitch in money to do that. So if you can imagine that the story is, the alleged fact is that 15-year-old Sergio Hernandez playing with friends. Apparently they were playing a game. Where they would run up to the United States side, touch the fence, and run back. At one point, Agent Mesa grabbed Hernandez's friend, apparently by the collar, in U.S. territory. Hernandez himself ran back into Mexican territory, hid behind one of the pillars from the rail bridge going into the culvert, and he was at that time shot and killed by Agent Hernandez. DOJ and DHS investigated the incident, and they did not bring criminal charges against Agent Mesa. Hernandez's parents sued in federal district court in Texas, both under statutorily and constitutionally. And to keep the procedural stuff brief, I'll just say that at district court level, all the counts were dismissed. The Hernandez's appealed to the Fifth Circuit. Only on the constitutional grounds. The Fifth Circuit originally said that the Fourth Amendment claims were blocked, were dismissed, but the Fifth Amendment claims could go forward under the recent 2008 decision, Boumediene. The Fifth Circuit then granted a rehearing of the case en banc. 15 judges participated. They issued a per curiam decision where they said there was no Fourth Amendment claim here and that they were divided on whether or not there was a Fifth Amendment claim, but Agent Mesa was entitled to qualified immunity, and so the motion to dismiss was granted. The Hernandez then petitioned to the Supreme Court. The petition languished very long at the Supreme Court, about a year and a half, from July 2015 to October 2016. At that point, the court did grant cert, obviously, and they granted it the two questions that Hernandez presented. The first one was, does a functional or formalist analysis govern the extraterritorial application of the Fourth Amendment's prohibition on unjustified deadly force as applied to the facts of this case? So we're asking, does the Verdugo case apply here, or does the Boumediene case apply here? And then they also granted cert and may qualified immunity be granted or denied based on facts such as the victim's legal status that were unknown to the officer at the time of the shooting. Now, the court also added on its own a third question, which was, can a Bivens claim be asserted under this the facts of, this case? We will get to Bivens in a second here. First, I'm going to talk about the extraterritoriality stuff and what happened in the court here. I'll just beginning, I guess, sort of break it down as what I saw. First, Alito and Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, clearly were not on the side of applying the Fourth Amendment in the context of this case. Justice Ginsburg clearly was, and then he had a couple justices, namely Justice Breyer and Justice Kagan, who seemed open to the idea of applying the Fourth Amendment, but not without some sort of properly tailored rule that they could use in additional cases, a rule that wasn't so narrowly limited to the facts of this case, so it wasn't just, you know, okay, you win, congratulations, done. But also, they didn't want someone that was something that was so broad that would cause confusion within the agencies, within the lower courts. So what was the rule that the petitioners tried to put forward to the court? And as best as I could piece together, this is what it was. They said the Fourth Amendment's constraints can apply when, number one, there's a cross-border shooting. Two, that shooting is by a federal civilian law enforcement or officer. Three, the officer is on U.S. soil. And four, the resulting injury is on the other side of the border but is in close proximity. Now, under questioning from Justice Alito, the petitioner's lawyer, Hernandez's lawyers, seemed to add a couple additional prongs, maybe impliedly, maybe not. But he also said something about if the victim is unarmed. And if the victim may have been injured in this concrete culvert or something similar, there was he kept on going back to, you know, I would urge the justices to take a look at the concrete culvert. It's a very unique situation, whatnot. But it wasn't 100% clear if he was trying to even limit it that even limit it more than beyond just the quote unquote close proximity. So this obviously frustrated Chief Justice Roberts very, very much, and Justice Alito, as I mentioned. Justice Roberts jokingly said, well, that's very convenient because it matches the exact facts of your case. Justice Alito said, look, the court needs to devise a rule to apply to other cases, and right now the only rule that you seem to be telling me is you win. And Breyer was, in my judgment, struggling with this as well. He was going back and forth a lot with Hernandez's attorney about, you know, to almost quote him exactly, he was saying, tell me what words we need to use that we can write down an opinion that would allow you to win, because that's what you want, but then also, you know, make it easier for the lower courts, not cause great confusion in other departments within DHS, within DOD. There was a lot of talk about drones here, about how they don't want to create a rule so broad that they might, you know, cause a drone pilot in Nevada who is carrying out an attack in Iraq to be sued in federal court. Justice Kagan sort of, you know, accepted that the rule was articulated, but then said, okay, but what is the reasoning for the rule? Tell me the why, if you will. I get what you're saying, but why? Give me some reason behind it. And the petitioner's lawyer said, well, it's because we have a problem on the southwest border with cross-border shootings. And he said that the border is a very unique place. And at this point, it sort of confused me, and it's odd because he made the petitioner's lawyer, Hernandez's lawyer, made a statement that the Border Patrol is 44,000 agents strong on the southwest border, and they interact with only with Mexican nationals. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to, you know, cause any disrespect to the man or anything like that, but both those statements are just not true. The Border Patrol, north border and southern border put together, is just shy of 20,000 agents. I'm not sure what the 44,000 came from, and they most certainly do not only interact with Mexican nationals. There are segments along the border where a majority of the flow these days is Central American individuals, not Mexican. But anyway, that aside, that's sort of where things were left with the petitioner and the back and forth with the justices, trying to identify some sort of rule. Now, Agent Mesa's attorney was nothing if not consistent. He was, you know, very strongly maintained that the border is finite, it is not elastic, and the Fourth Amendment constitutional protections end there. Wars have been fought over borders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He and the government took the exact position, and that was that Verdugo established a rule that the Fourth Amendment does not apply to some mass of persons outside the United States, and Boumediene did nothing to change that. He made the point that the control over this cement culvert is so small in comparison to the control that the United States has over Gitmo, obviously going back to Boumediene. So presumably he was saying that if even Boumediene were to apply in this situation, it would be the same result in that the Fourth Amendment didn't apply because there's just not much control. So to touch upon this control argument a little bit as well, because it came up in other areas of oral arguments, it was weird because there was talk about control over the culvert, but in a very different sort of context. The petitioner, the Hernandez lawyer, he relied on congressional testimony from former Border Patrol Chief Mike Fisher from 2011 talked about the Border Patrol's authority projecting outward from the border and into Mexico. That was congressional testimony, which in all transparency was a committee hearing that was before the committee that I work on, and I was president at this hearing. And this quote of Chief Fisher's has been used in border litigation, not just in the Mesa case, but also out in Arizona as well. It's slightly out of context. I don't quite agree with it being used the way they're trying to trying to use it in litigation context. But nonetheless, that is what they were trying to say, was that the Border Patrol is so unique and the border is so unique that they project this authority outward. Justice Breyer kept up bringing the fact that this culvert is operated, maintained, and repaired jointly by the U.S. and Mexico. And so maybe, you know, he fully said that's not as much control as there was in Gitmo, but you know, maybe it's enough under Boumediene to have the Fourth Amendment attach. So where does that leave us with extraterritoriality? Well, I said two justices, Alito and Roberts, were pretty firmly no. Ginsburg was a yes, and then two were sort of, well, maybe, but you know, we need some sort of rule, and I wasn't quite sure, 100% sure if a proper rule was put forth. Two justices really didn't say much about extraterritoriality, and notably, one of them was Justice Kennedy. Obviously, the commentary going in here was that all eyes were going to be on Kennedy because he wrote the opinion in Boumediene. He had a concurrence opinion in Verdugo. He did not say much at all about either case or which way he might be leaning there. He pretty much just stuck to the Bivens arguments, which I'll get to in a second here. One thing I wanted to say was that sort of the court seemed to be operating at the extremes when we were talking about the extraterritoriality, the Fourth Amendment stuff, which was sort of frustrating to me because they were pretty much just saying, okay, well, we don't want to have such a narrow rule that just is confined to the facts of this case. But then on the other hand, I should say, they were saying, "Well, we don't want to, you know, affect drone pilots." That was pretty much the only other context that they sort of tried to compare it to, which was frustrating for me because I think we need to think of it in other terms besides just drones or military application. We need to think about it in another context of the southern border itself, where there isn't a concrete culvert, where there isn't such an area of land that is jointly operated by the U.S. and Mexico, where there is just a sort of line in the sand, if you will, such as where places in Arizona. What about the maritime environment? What about the maritime border? What about Coast Guard operations on the West Coast or in Alaska, et cetera? How would such a rule, if accepted, be applied in different areas along the border and not, you know, excluding the military application, if you will? Okay, so Bivens. Remember that the court added this question, the Bivens question itself. This was not part of the original questions presented. And the government seemed to sort of take that hint, and they spent a majority of their written brief and a vast majority of their time at oral arguments talking about the Bivens issue. The government labeled the Bivens issue the quote-unquote antecedent question of the case. That one commentator said that all eyes were on the Bivens issue in this case, and I don't disagree with that at all. On this issue, there was a much more clearly defined split, as far as I can tell, sort of breaking into two camps. One was sort of led by Justice Kagan, and their argument was, look, in this case, it is either Bivens or nothing. There is no statutory remedy. There's no administrative remedy. They did not bring murder charges or any other sort of criminal charges against Agent Mesa. So if we say no to Bivens, we're just cutting them off. The other camp was saying, look, in Bivens, we look for special factors, and the ultimate special factor is foreign affairs, foreign relations. And by virtue of this being on the border, by virtue of this being a cross-border shooting, that this is a foreign relations case, foreign affairs case, and we need to leave it to the political branch. Now, unfortunately for the petitioner, for Hernandez, a leading advocate of this argument was Justice Kennedy, it seemed. He called this an extraordinary case to be extended to extend Bivens to. He said that if there is indeed a problem at the border, then it seems it would be a very sensitive matter of foreign affairs. Add to it that they haven't extended Bivens in roughly 30 years or so. And as far as I can tell, he was very, very hesitant to extend Bivens to the case here. So that's sort of how I saw things come out. I'll go over some possible outcomes here. Obviously, you know, the usual thing is if it's 4-4, then in this case, the Fifth Circuit case would stand, or the decision would stand without a nationwide precedent. But I believe Amy Howe over at SCOTUS Blog had a very good post about this the day after the argument. She brought the possibility that if there's a 4-4 tie, they might wait until Judge Gorsuch is, if and when he is confirmed, and then rehear the case this fall. One issue I wanted to bring up about a 4-4 tie, if they do release a 4-4 tie opinion, is that there is a case pending in the Ninth Circuit right now called Rodriguez v. Swartz, or I guess Swartz v. Rodriguez. It is out of Arizona. It is a very similar fact pattern. Difference is, I guess, that there is no, you know, concrete culvert or anything like that. The victim in that case was just standing on a sidewalk across from Nogales, Arizona, in Mexico. And the federal agent in that case was charged with murder and is currently being charged with murder. The questions are very similar at the Ninth Circuit. The district court in Arizona came to almost a polar opposite conclusion that the Fifth Circuit did. So if they were to release a 4-4 tie, and I should say that the Ninth Circuit had oral arguments in that case last October, and has been, as far as I can tell, just sitting on their opinion waiting for guidance from the Supreme Court. And so presumably if they issue a 4-4 tie, the Ninth Circuit could and would probably release their opinion. If it's at odds with the Fifth Circuit, we would have a clean circuit split on the issue and be right back up. So if I had to guess, I think that especially the Bivens issue being a pretty clear split, as far as I can tell, that the Supreme Court is probably going to be hearing this case again in one form or another. So I will leave it at that, and I will turn it back over to Laura. I'm happy to take some questions.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions, I'll ask one of my own. Did the qualified immunity question ever come up during oral argument?
Barely. Probably like 99.9% of the discussion was around Bivens and Fourth Amendment. I think 0.1% is being generous for qualified immunity. It was none of the attorneys brought it up themselves. excuse me, it was a question from Chief Justice Roberts to the to Mesa's attorney, the respondent's attorney, simply asking something about that he's never heard of an instance where qualified immunity based on jurisdiction, that is based on where the officer was standing when the injury occurred. And the Mesa's attorney simply said, no, Your Honor, I've never heard of a case that would fit that fact pattern. Period. End of discussion. That was it.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'll make a brief announcement. Our next telephone conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, March 8th. The subject of that call will be a preview of the Supreme Court case Impression Products versus Lexmark International. That call will feature Professor Adam Mossif, co-founder and director of academic programs and senior scholar at the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property and professor at the Antonin Scalia Law School, Professor David Olson, associate professor at Boston College Law School, Mr. Stephen Tepp, president and CEO of Sentinel Worldwide and professorial lecturer in law at GW, and our moderator, Professor Kristen Osenga, professor of law at University of Richmond. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions, I'll ask another. Which side received more questions during oral argument?
It was pretty even. Obviously, the government got a lot of questions about Bivens just because that's pretty much all they wanted to talk about. As far as, it was really, I guess I would say that the petitioners got a little more questioning the Hernandez side just because Breyer in particular was really peppering about give us a rule, give us a rule, help me out here. It was almost like a help me help you type of deal. It's like, okay, if you know, we can't just say congratulations, you win. We need something more than that. We need a durable, reasonable, meaningful rule that we can apply further on down the road. So and then, or at least a couple of times where he didn't get quite the answer he was going back for. And I think just before his time was up, Breyer was saying, I'm going to give you one last chance. Please, if you have anything else to say, say it now. And who knows in total if that satisfied him. So we'll see.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Our lines are open. How fast do you think turnover will be on this case?
It could be not until next year, depending on whether they rehear it or not, or 4-4 until we get some sort of final answer. But I guess it's possible that I shouldn't speak with great certainty that it's going to be 4-4 because, you know, who the heck really knows. But this is obviously a very sensitive issue, and a lot of people are watching it, and I guess because of the degree that they were examining what a proper rule would look like, I'm sure they want to be extra sure that they get this right, and so it could be it could be late. We could be looking at April or May here.
Again, to ask a question. Oh, we have our first caller. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, Steve. Chris Gardner. I actually used to work for you on Homeland Security.
Chris.
Law school. Doing well. Did Justice Sotomayor have anything to say about this during oral arguments?
Not so much on the issue. I said at the beginning there were two justices that were pretty much silent on extraterritorial stuff. I pretty much only talked about Kennedy. That's my mistake. Counsel Sotomayor is actually pretty much saved all her fire for the for the Bivens stuff, and she was clearly pretty much squarely with Justice Kagan on the Bivens stuff. Saying, I think at one point she was saying, well, isn't this family entitled to something if they are found to be on the winning side, on the merits? Not much on the Fourth Amendment stuff, but it was pretty clear which way she was leaning with Bivens.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum conference calls. You can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. I'll make a final call for questions. To ask one, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. But not seeing any, would you like to make some closing remarks?
I would just add, I forgot to add at the beginning here, that there is another excellent Federalist Society podcast on this issue for, I believe, February 13th. It was obviously before the oral arguments had taken place. And it much fuller argument, I guess, debate on the issues underlying this case. I know it was Professor Steve Vladek of UT, and I believe that the other gentleman's name was Mark Kent of Fortnum. So if you want to learn more about the case, I would direct you to that podcast as well. Also, the Fifth Circuit, when they issued the per curiam decision, had a lot of concurring and dissenting opinions there, which in the case of a 4-4 tie, it would be worth going and checking out that too. But I will leave that to you rather than trying to dive in right now.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Stephen for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.